The following 15 minutes are sponsored by Chicago Typographical Union No. 16 to state their own views on the printer's strike against the Chicago newspapers.
Meet the union printers. The real reasons for the newspaper strike in Chicago. This is the truth. These are the facts. More than 5,000 members of Chicago Typographical Union No. 16, Chicago citizens, your friends and neighbors, present Meet the Union Printers. Chicago's union typos believe that you, the listener, are vitally concerned in their strike against the six big Chicago daily newspapers, the Hammond Times, and the Chicago Defender. That's why this program is presented in your interest for your information. Tonight we present a report on the first 7 months of labor management relations under the Taft-Hartley Act. To help us get at the facts and get them straightened out, we have Joe Roden, chairman of the Scale Committee for Chicago Typographical Union, and Nick DiPietro, executive secretary, Chicago Federation of Printing Trades Unions. Well, let's try to get out the basic facts about the Taft-Hartley Law up to date. Exactly how old is the law, Mr. DiPietro?
It was enacted into law over President Truman's veto on June 23, 1947. That makes the Taft-Hartley Law exactly 7 months old tonight. And tonight also marks the end of the second month of No. 16 strike against the Chicago newspapers.
But the entire law didn't go into effect on June 23rd, did it?
No, the section on union security went into operation after 2 months, on August 22, 1947.
In other words, the law itself has been on the books for 7 months, but all its provisions have been effective only 5 months.
That's right. But it's been long enough for us to get a clear picture of several important things about how NLRB General Counsel Robert Denham is interpreting it as primarily an anti-labor law. What do you think, Joe?
Things will come to a real head in the first half of this year, 1948, with a real crisis during July and August, when many signed contracts before the Taft-Hartley Law went into effect will expire. AFL President William Green said a few weeks ago, and I quote, "The blow-off will come at the expiration of these contracts in 1948, close quotes.
In that sense, by the way, it's important to understand that Chicago Typographical Union is playing a big part in leading the entire labor movement. This union's refusal to become ensnared in a crippling Taft-Hartley contract is being watched by trade union members all over the country.
Do you expect the United States Supreme Court to rule that some sections of the law are unconstitutional, Mr. DiPietro?
We surely do. One big question, though, is whether the court will be able to separate the various sections of the law. It's our opinion that a thread of unconstitutionality runs through the entire law. And we are confirmed in that opinion by the recent decision of the California Supreme Court, throwing out that state's Hot Cargo Act. It is possible that the United States Supreme Court may decide that only certain parts of the Taft-Hartley Act are in violation of the federal Constitution, and still permit the remainder of the act to stay in effect.
Well, as I recall it, Mr. Roden, the National Association of Manufacturers and most of the newspaper editorial writers claimed that all the Taft-Hartley Act was intended to do was equalize labor management relations.
The word equality went out the window when the Taft-Hartley Law was enacted. Just 7 short months. And already we can prove that the law puts a shotgun in the hands of both employers and the government. And the shotgun is aimed right at the working man and his union.
Mr. DiPietro, what do you want to say about this equality argument?
All we have to do is look at the facts. Out of a total of 16 complaints about which we know that have been issued by the National Labor Relations Board since the law was passed, 15 have been issued against unions. Only one was brought against an employer. Yet unions have filed twice as many charges of unfair labor practices against employers as were filed by employers against unions. Since last June 23, injunctions have been asked against unions in 4 cases of which we know, and yet not one single injunction has been sought against an employer. Cases against unions have been processed with unseemly haste, and cases against employers lag far behind. Where's your equality?
The law is unfair in dozens of ways. For example, unions must publish detailed reports to all members, but corporations do not have to issue such reports to their stockholders and to the public. Is this equality? Or take this one. Union members employed by one company cannot call on fellow union members of another company to help them in their fight for better conditions. But one company can seek the aid of another company to break a strike or a lockout of its employees, and anybody aiding the employees by refusing to handle struck or unfair work is liable to injunctions and damage suit. Is that equality?
Well, I think you've proven your point. Can you offer any specific examples of how the law has been applied so far, Mr. DiPietro?
One of the first major actions of the NLRB since the passing of the act was the attempt to get an injunction against AFL carpenters in Chattanooga, Tennessee. They struck rather than work beside non-union floor layers in a house they were building. The NLRB claimed such a strike was a secondary boycott. Fortunately, the court refused to issue the injunction.
Then, there's an even more startling case of the AFL Longshoremen's Association, who went on strike at Albany, New York, to prevent the companies from transferring certain items to land transportation. Here, NLRB General Counsel Robert Denham, who is the Taft Hartley Act czar, actually did obtain an injunction to stop the strike. Now, the injunction was based on the employer's charge that the strike involved a secondary boycott, which is banned by the Taft Hartley Act. The board held that a strike which interferes with an employer's business obviously prevents him from doing business with his customers and is therefore a secondary boycott.
Well, do you think then that the NLRB has been pressing the new law to its full limit as an employer tool against unions?
Even beyond the limit. The law requires, for example, that any union wanting to be certified by the NLRB for collective bargaining purposes must file registration papers and non-communist affidavits. In addition to the 70 AFL and 14 CIO international unions that had been certified by the end of November, there were 683 independent local unions and 30 independent internationals. Now, many of these independents are bona fide unions, of course, but among those the board certified are some rather notorious company unions.
Yes, and by definition, a company union is a management control organization against instead of for the interest of the workers. Under Wagner Act procedure, most company unions were dissolved, but the Taft-Hartley Act has already encouraged a lot of them to come back into the picture.
Well, does a company union under the Taft-Hartley Act get special breaks?
In some cases. Over in Gloversville, New York, in response to a management petition, the NLRB ordered an election in which a company union sought recognition over a bona fide union which had held a contract with the plant's former owners and claimed an oral contract with the present management. But the NLRB went even further. It refused to let the bona fide union have a place on the ballot because the union had not registered and filed affidavits with the board. Thus, the board, in effect, established the principle of letting an employer petition for an election at the request of a company union while denying a legitimate union access to the polls.
But doesn't the Taft-Hartley Act require that a union must register and sign the affidavits in order to obtain certification as collective bargaining agent?
That's right, it does. But Congress did not say that a union had to be registered in order to have its name placed on a collective bargaining election ballot. After all, a bona fide union may win an election overwhelmingly and go on to bargain with the employer without formal certification by the board. There were thousands of cases under the Wagner Act where collective bargaining between labor and management went on all the time without board certification of any kind.
How about the board's efforts to obtain injunctions under the Taft-Hartley Act?
We think the most outrageous example of all is the attempt by NLRB czar Robert Denham to obtain an injunction against the International Typographical Union and every one of its offices. The injunction request, which would be argued in the federal district court at Indianapolis February the 9th, even goes so far as to ask that our international offices be restrained from advising our affiliated local unions on matters of policy.
What else does Mr. Denham ask for in this injunction request?
Essentially, what he asks is that the elected international officers of our union stop all efforts to carry out the policies that were adopted unanimously at our convention in Cleveland last summer. And that means, in effect, that our international officers would have to stop doing all the things the publishers claim that they are doing that the publishers don't like.
In other words, you think that Mr. Denham is using the powers of his office to interfere on the side of the publishers and against the union?
There is no doubt of it. And while we believe the Taft-Hartley law is bad enough as it stands, the way the NLRB is being used to enforce it makes the law even worse. The way it's working out, we find that Denham is ganging up with the employers to beat the union at every turn.
But even so, many employers are still not content with what the NLRB is doing for them. In a number of cases, employers are making compliance with their private interpretation of the law by the union a prerequisite before they will even sit down and negotiate with a union, even though the use of NLRB facilities is not involved at all, even though the union has been the recognized bargaining agent for the employees for years and years.
How about the freedom of speech clauses in the Taft-Hartley Act? How are they working, Mr. Roden?
The best example that I know about concerns the strike out on the West Coast where a strikebreaker was called a scab by a picket.
Well, what happened?
The employer filed a complaint with the NLRB, and Denham tried to prove that calling a man a scab was intimidation under the Taft-Hartley Act. In the hearing on the case, a union spokesman pointed out that the strikebreaker had cursed at the picket. But the NLRB attorney, Representative Denham, said, and I quote, "Under the Taft-Hartley law, if you swear at them for any reason, you are using intimidation. The law does not concern itself with the conduct of anyone toward the picket line."
In other words, a strikebreaker can say just about anything he likes to a picket, and the picket is not supposed to answer back. Is that it?
Well, that's the way that Czar Denham would like it to be. But fortunately, the argument of Denham in that West Coast case was later thrown out, dismissed altogether by the trial examiner. He pointed out that the picket line excitement was provoked not by the union, but by the management of the plant.
Well, has anything been done by the government to carry out the Taft-Hartley prohibitions against political activities financed by unions, Mr. DiPietro?
There have been a number of unions that have gone right ahead and engaged in political action in the same way they always had in the past. So far, no charges have been made by the Attorney General's office or by the NLRB.
Well, do you think something is likely to break along that front before long?
It's hard to tell. Even the sponsors of the act, Senator Taft and Congressman Hartley, have indicated they're not so sure the ban on political activity was a very wise provision. We in the unions believe, of course, that it's a complete violation of our simple rights as American citizens.
Well, Mr. DiPietro, I understand you're the chairman of Chicago Typographical Union's legislative committee. Do your union members expect to take much part in the 1948 election campaign?
We certainly do, more than ever before in history. We're already breaking down our membership lists into wards and precincts, and we know about other unions that are doing the same thing.
What's your major objective for 1948?
The big job of replacing the men who supported the Taft-Hartley Act in Congress by men who are on the side of the people.
Well, do you plan to work with this new political and education league that's been announced by the American Federation of Labor?
Definitely, yes. Joseph Keenan, secretary of the Chicago Federation of Labor, has been designated as one of the three men who will set up that nationwide league. And we're going to help make Chicago a standout city in terms of political action by trade union members in 1948. Joe Roden here is the vice chairman of Chicago Typographical Union's legislative committee.
Well, Mr. Roden, can you say anything this early about the form your members' political activities will take?
We are going to work on the job of getting as many voters as possible to register so that we can be sure that everybody is eligible to vote. And finally, we aim to mobilize voters and to make sure that they get to the polls on that second Tuesday in November.
Well, it sounds as if you do indeed have a lot to do in the next 9 months. You've just heard an interview on Taft-Hartley, the first 7 months. Taking part in the program were Joe Roden, chairman of the Scale Committee for Chicago Typographical Union, and Nick DiPietro, executive secretary, Chicago Federation of Printing Trades Unions. Be listening again tomorrow, Saturday. Tomorrow, the time is 6:15, for a special program of songs. This is WCFL Chicago 11.